You're listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. Podcast to Practice brings you expert-led, independent medical education discussions, inspiring healthcare professionals to maximize their learning and make measurable changes in their own clinical practice. This podcast is part of an independent medical education program entitled Awareness Advances Action, Optimizing Outcomes for Patients with Generalized Myasthenia Gravis. It is intended for healthcare professionals and is supported by an independent educational grant from Merck KGaA, Darmstadt, Germany, and UCB, Inc.
Hello, my name is Kelly Guathmey, and I'm a neuromuscular neurologist at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And I would like to welcome our learners today to this independent medical education podcast episode called New and Emerging Therapies for GMG, FcRn Receptor Antagonist and Complement Inhibition. And I would like to also introduce Dr. Pushpa Narayanaswamy. Dr. Narayanaswamy is a professor of neurology and the vice chair of clinical operations at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much for having me here today. So it's exciting. There's so many things going on in myasthenia gravis. I think it's very timely.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. It's wonderful to have you. Before we jump into the neonatal Fc receptor antagonists as well as the complement inhibitors, I'd like to first have us go over our traditional standard of care treatment. So if you wouldn't mind walking us through what we've been doing for the last many decades, that would be helpful context. Thank you.
Yes, I agree. Because there's been so much going on that we've done before these therapies. And of course, the first sort of line of therapies, as in most diseases, is just symptomatic treatment with acetylcholine esterase inhibitors, just to increase the amount of acetylcholine available at the neuromuscular junction and improve function temporarily. But we all know that myasthenia is an autoimmune disease, and so the disease-modifying treatments are to actually turn off in some way the autoimmune response that produces the autoantibodies. And in order to do so, we've borrowed a lot of drugs from our rheumatology colleagues, I think, over the years. Most of them have really not been studied or formally approved for myasthenia gravis. They've sort of been grandfathered into myasthenia gravis. Corticosteroids, glucocorticoids, prednisone or prednisolone is one of the best known and I think most often used drugs. And it's very, very effective, as you know. If only it didn't have all of those side effects, it would be fantastic, right? And then, of course, we have the non-steroidal immunosuppressant agents, and we use them in a couple of situations. We use them when prednisone is contraindicated, which really don't want to worsen diabetes or worsen cardiovascular risk or weight gain in somebody by giving them prednisone. Or we give them prednisone just to get that quick action, because prednisone, in addition to being very effective, acts within a month or so in most cases. And so once we get that, we want to take them off that prednisone because of side effects. So we add in one of the non-steroidal immunosuppressant agents, and I'll talk about which those are in a second. Or in some patients, they may not really have a full response to prednisone. And so we need that therapy as an add-on therapy for effect rather than to prevent side effects. Most commonly, I think, at least in North America, we use azathioprine, mycophenolate, sometimes cyclosporin. Tacrolimus is used more often in Japan. Rituximab, sometimes depending on the autoantibody subtype, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. And then some of the other drugs that we tend to use more rarely, methotrexate, for instance. I think those would be the major ones I can think about. And of course, we have other therapies for other situations when patients are in crisis. For instance, when we use plasma exchange or we use IV intravenous immunoglobulin. And we can use these drugs as maintenance therapies rarely in patients who don't really do well with some of the other treatments I talked about. And finally, of course, we have thymectomy for non-thymomatous myasthenia gravis. So thymectomy for patients with thymoma is to treat their thymoma. But thymectomy, most often for younger patients with myasthenia gravis, to remove that source of immune stimulation that is felt to be the cause of that ongoing autoantibody production in patients with acetylcholine receptor antibody positive myasthenia, not for MuSK myasthenia, sometimes for seronegative myasthenia, but not for MuSK. I think I covered them.
Yes, that was very comprehensive. Thank you for that. And then just kind of now moving into our emerging therapies, these newer ones that everyone's talking about, you know, we can really break these down into big categories, right? So we have our B-cell directed therapy. I think you already mentioned rituximab. We have our complement inhibitors, eculizumab, ravulizumab, zilucoplan. We have our neonatal Fc receptor antagonist, nipocalimab, efgartigimod. We have rozanolixizumab. And then T-cell directed therapies is two that are emerging. And so we have a lot to talk about, which is why this is divided over two different podcasts. And so just starting off with our FcRn receptor antagonist, if you can kind of describe those for us, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot to talk about. So the FcRn stands for neonatal Fc receptor. And the FcRn receptor, as the name indicates, was actually first described in the placenta. And there in the placenta, the function of this receptor is to actually, in the third trimester of pregnancy, transfer IgG from mom to the baby. So all of the good antibodies that the mom has from immunization, et cetera, go to the baby, because the baby can't make antibodies in their first couple of months. Now, how does that come to play in myasthenia gravis? Well, it's interesting because these FcRn receptors are also present in other tissues, including the vascular endothelium. And as you know, immunoglobulin G is the immunoglobulin with the longest half-life, about 4 weeks. Everything else lasts for a couple of days, maybe a week. And the way that immunoglobulin G manages to last for 4 weeks in the circulation is by this recycling pathway that is modulated or sort of brought about by the FcRn receptors. So in the blood, in the physiologic pH of the blood, IgG sort of just floats around, and then it internalizes into these vascular endothelial cells and forms these little vesicles. So the cell membrane pinches off, and these vesicles are called endosomes. And on the surface of these endosomes, the FcRn receptors are present from the surface of the endothelial cell, the membrane. And the pH of the endosome is acidic. And in that acidic pH, IgG binds robustly or with high affinity to these FcRn receptors. And once it binds, it gets circulated back to the surface. And at the physiologic pH of the surface, the endosome opens up, releases the IgG, and it goes on its way. However, the IgG that's not bound to the FcRn receptor goes off and gets degraded in the lysosomes. So if you want to take away IgG, what you do is take one of these compounds that have much higher affinity for the FcRn receptor than does the native IgG. Then you block those receptors. And so native IgG has nowhere to go but into the lysosomes, and it gets degraded. And there go all of your pathogenic antibodies as well. So that's the mechanism of action of these drugs. It's a very interesting mechanism.
Yes, it is very interesting. And so you mentioned the pathogenic antibodies. It also clears normal IgG as well. Is that
exactly
right?
Exactly. So because it's non-specific, right? It clears everything, including the normal IgG. So in fact, when you look at these studies, they not only look at acetylcholine receptor antibody levels, but total IgG levels. And usually, depending on the drug, the total clearance is almost 70 to 80%. So the IgG levels drop anywhere between 60 to 80%, depending on the drug, from baseline.
Which is very impressive, I think. And so in contrast to that mechanism of action, if we can pivot and chat about complement inhibition a little bit and how those drugs work.
Right. And so that's a little bit different. And it's also a little less it's a little more specific in terms of the action than the FcRns. The FcRn antagonists, as you said, are going to remove pretty much all IgGs. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter whether the IgG we want to remove is MuSK antibody or acetylcholine receptor antibody or LRP4 antibody. Theoretically, they're all going to be removed, right? They're all going to be reduced, at least, if not removed completely. The levels are going to be reduced. Now, on the other hand, the complement inhibitors have a very specific function. What they really do is to inhibit one part of the complement cascade, and that, you know, is a cascade of 9 proteins. It can be activated by several mechanisms, and the one that we consider here is antigen-antibody complexes activating it. So the antigen-antibody complexes here we are talking about is the complex between the acetylcholine receptor and the acetylcholine receptor antibody. Once that combination happens, complement is activated, and it goes all the way from C1 through C9. That's the complement. But at C5, you have, when C5 is activated, it breaks down to C5A and C5B. And when that happens, C5B then combines with C6, 7, 8, and multiple copies of C9 and forms this compound that we refer to as a membrane attack complex back from my immunology days a long time ago. And basically, these membrane attack complexes really punch holes in the membrane, destroy the membrane, and destroy the acetylcholine receptors. So that's really what happens. So as you can imagine, so this is good in acetylcholine receptor antibody-mediated myasthenia gravis. But MuSK myasthenia gravis is not something that can be treated by these drugs, because the MuSK antibody, which is an IgG4 antibody compared to the acetylcholine receptor antibody, which are IgG 1 and 3 subclasses, the MuSK antibody does not fix complement. So it doesn't actually activate that complement cascade. It has, and therefore, if it does not activate the complement cascade, there is no point in giving those patients a complement inhibitor. And of course, we've got 3 of those drugs. We've got eculizumab, we've got ravulizumab, which is really eculizumab, the same monoclonal antibody, which is also a monoclonal antibody that is engineered for longer half-life. So you can give it every 8 weeks instead of every 2 weeks. And then you have zilucoplan, which is not a monoclonal antibody. It's a macrocyclic peptide. It's a small compound. And the interesting thing about it is also that it can be given subcutaneously, self-administered, and it's given daily.
That's very helpful. And I'm curious to hear your answer to this. I mean, as you've already said, these newer therapeutics have completely different mechanisms of action compared to our traditional therapeutics we've been using. And so for you, do you really envision that these newer therapeutics have a role only in treatment refractory myasthenia gravis, or do you feel like they're being used, you know, kind of across the board these days?
Right. And that's a really good question. I think the answer to that is evolving. It's certainly evolving in my own practice. And I'll be interested after this to hear what you do. But the initial trial, the REGAIN trial, eculizumab, those patients who were enrolled in that trial had refractory myasthenia gravis defined as failure of at least 2 immunotherapies. And again, this definition of refractory, especially in the setting of this new therapies itself, is controversial. And that's a matter for another day's discussion. Yeah. But the subsequent trials did not require that patients who received these therapies had to be refractory. So I think one of the advantages of both these groups of therapies is how quickly they act. Sometimes within 1 week, a couple of weeks, and certainly within 1 month. And that's really rapid. And we're not talking that quickly, but just some mild improvement. We are talking a good amount of improvement, nice improvement within that short period of time. That's a real advantage over some of the other therapies. Although prednisone, as we said, acts quickly. Plasma exchange, of course, acts quickly, but that's not something we consider in all patients. So I think that's a real advantage. And so the question sometimes arises in my mind, you know, just given the rapidity of action, is that something that we should be considering in all patients? But more than that, I think one of the issues that really brings it down is the side effect profile of prednisone. So should we be giving this as a steroid-sparing agent initially, may get them better quickly, and at the same time maybe add azathioprine or mycophenolate, which, as we know, takes several months to act. They're also doing 2 different things, right? So we're talking about actually switching off the immune response in one and switching off the sort of the consequence of the immune response in the other, like either removing the antibodies or switching off complement. So I think that needle is moving in terms of using them earlier. I wouldn't say that all patients are suitable for this. Definitely not. I mean, there are patients who you give them a whiff of prednisone and they're just fine and they don't have any side effects. So I think that's where I'm going.
Okay. It sounds like we practice exactly the same way in that regard. I am still a big believer in non-steroidal immunosuppressant therapies in certain patients. They definitely have a long-term role. And I agree some patients can still get away with a low dose of prednisone. But I've become very impatient, you know, waiting. And so I think we all want to get our patients better more quickly, safely, with less side effects. And so especially in our brittle diabetics that you don't want to put on high dose corticosteroids, this is really, you know, a new opportunity for them, I think. So thank you for that.
And yeah, so I totally agree. It's just a quick other point. I mean, we sometimes refer to this as a bridging therapy in this world of myasthenia that's rapidly evolving, right? So you bridge them with these drugs and get them better while you wait for the other drugs to kick in.
Yes, I'm still experimenting with that. So it's going relatively well.
Me too. But so, I do think that the way the needle is moving for me is I've started considering the side effects of other therapies, their relative side effect profile, in addition to just the effectiveness.
Right, exactly. Thank you for that. And now, I mean, we only have a few moments left, I think, but if we can spend some time going through some of the key clinical trial results for these therapeutics. So if we can start off, if you don't mind going through those for the FcRn receptor antagonist, sure, that would be great.
Sure. And most, you know, we've got these two drugs now. The clinical trials are sort of similar. We've got three drugs now. We've got nipocalimab as well. The phase 3 trial results are out. So it's three drugs. So we've got efgartigimod. That trial was the first drug, and that was the first one that was approved. That was a 26-week trial. The drug is given intravenously, 10 milligrams per kilogram. And it's given, this is cyclical dosing. And the nice thing about that trial that was that the cycles after the first two cycles could actually be changed. The duration of the treatment cycles could be changed depending on how patients did. But there were some problems with that because they had to force patients to actually get worse before they could give them another treatment when they were changing the duration. Regardless, patients with moderate disease, MG-ADL greater than 5, I believe, or 5 or 6, I believe, were enrolled. And these were patients with generalized myasthenia gravis. So each patient received 10 milligrams IV, so that's 4 shots. So that's over 3 weeks. And they waited for another 4 weeks. And the primary outcome was at that 4-week endpoint after the first cycle. So that was the primary outcome measure. And more patients who, I think it was about 60% of patients compared to about 20-25% of patients on the MG-ADL, 30% of patients on MG-ADL who were responders. And there was a definition of responders. They had to get better within 1 week after that first cycle, the last dose, and stay better for the rest of that cycle for 4 weeks, if I remember correctly. The difference between the MG-ADL change from baseline was also statistically significant in the two groups. And some patients, about 30% of patients actually subsequently after the first primary outcome was assessed, could go almost 12 weeks without repeating the drug. The second drug, and this has an open label trial, there's been a trial of a subcutaneous formulation that sort of proved equivalence between the two drugs. And then there has also been a trial is looking at seronegative myasthenia gravis. The other drug we're talking about is rozanolixizumab. So that's a little bit different. It's subcutaneous. It was given every week for 6 weeks, and then the primary outcome was assessed at 12 weeks. So 6 weeks after that last dose, primary outcome was assessed. Again, similar primary outcomes. And again, more or less similar efficacy results, both for MG-ADL and for QMG, which is usually the first two outcomes that we look at, as you know. Both of these trials did not show much of a signal in terms of infection. You mentioned this drop in total IgG levels. So one always has this worry about infection risk because of that. At least in the duration of the trial, there really wasn't much of a signal. The side effects mostly were headache, urinary tract infection, and respiratory tract infection, but they were not too different between placebo and drug. And finally, we just got the nipocalimab phase 3 And the drug has just been approved, I believe, yesterday or day before yesterday. Yeah.
Thanks.
So phase three. So nipocalimab, again, a monoclonal antibody. This is also given intravenously, but this is continuous dosing. So all the three trials are a little bit different. This is continuous dosing. They received a loading dose, 30 milligrams per kilogram, I believe. And then they got 15 milligrams per kilogram every 2 weeks. And here, it was a 24-week trial, so a little bit longer. And the way they did it was, again, primary outcome. They wanted to show stability of that outcome. So it's not enough if you improve with your MG-ADL by 2 points at one point time point. So they combined week 22, 23, 24 and looked to see what was the change from baseline and also how many people had that clinically meaningful improvement of 2 points ADL and that 3 weeks, you know, stable for those 3 weeks. And again, the drug performed better than placebo. Again, side effect profile was very similar. So lots of options, different routes of administration. There was one ADAPT trial also, I think it's ADAPT Next, that looked at sort of continuous dosing. So cyclical dosing versus continuous dosing, et cetera.
You know, so many options emerging. And just want to point this out, some of these therapeutics are also approved for MuSK myasthenia, right?
Yes. Rosinolixizumab is approved for MuSK myasthenia. It was interesting that the change from baseline on MG-ADL was actually much more robust in the small group of MuSK myasthenics than the whole group, seropositive group. So that was really pretty cool.
Yeah, it's very promising. And so quickly, we'll go through just some of the trials for the complement inhibitors. You've already mentioned REGAIN and the patient population that was enrolled being a refractory one. But yeah, maybe if you want to focus more on ravulizumab and zilucoplan, that would
sure.
be wonderful.
So I will say, though, that interestingly, the REGAIN trial did not meet its primary endpoint. And that's an important thing to say. It got approved despite that, because that was the statistical analysis that was used on the behest of the FDA. And so it's, again, matter for another discussion. But unlike the REGAIN trial, as I mentioned, the CHAMPION trial of ravulizumab they did not need to have refractory patients. And it was very similar, 26 weeks. The overall difference in MG-ADL between the two groups, placebo and ravulizumab, was somewhat less than that in the REGAIN trials. The proportion of patients who improved 2 points was about the same, I think. And again, no difference in side effects. Zilucoplan, again, unlike the other two, subcutaneously administered. This was a really short trial. It was 12 weeks, neat and crisp, and showed a benefit in both primary outcomes. There were no meningococcal infections in any of these trials. There was one meningococcal infection in the open label extension of REGAIN. Patient recovered and actually, I believe, went on to continue treatment.
Great. Thank you so much. This has been such a robust discussion about these newer therapeutics. I'm excited to join you for the next podcast shortly to continue this conversation about emerging therapies. And I just want to thank the audience for listening to this podcast and encourage everyone to listen to the other video podcasts in the series and download the clinician and patient resources on the program website. So thank you, Pushpa, and I'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Kelly. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Podcast to Practice, brought to you by Springer Health Plus IME. For more information on our educational programs available, visit ime.springerhealthplus.com.